This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Everything is Awful and Other Observations, written and performed by Matt Belisai.
For my family, I blame them for everything. Everything is Awful and Other Embarrassments. I was 6 years old when I last peed my pants. I say this not to brag, although making it over 20 years without pissing my pants is actually quite an accomplishment, to be perfectly honest, but to bear my shame. I was at my best friend Kenny's house after school, drinking juice boxes and waging war with toy soldiers, you know, six-year-old stuff. As our battle wore on, my body slowly devolved into the cross-legged dance of the six-year-old in distress, writhing to console the mounting pressure of my bladder. As my soldiers fell in the heat of battle, I crept painfully closer to my limit. I was dressed in my finest outfit for a school assembly earlier that day, some hideous combination of red, black, and white my mother thought was stylish in 1996. In retrospect, that outfit probably deserved to be pissed on. You can't put a budding homosexual in an ill-conceived pattern and expect him not to urinate all over it. Regardless, there I was, standing in front of the toilet. I'd managed at least to make it to the bathroom, furiously struggling with the buttons of my fancy six-year-old pants. And yes, my mother chose not only a hideous pattern, but dress pants with buttons instead of a zipper, yet another choice that begged for this very outcome. I'd held my composure for as long as I could. My hands helplessly fumbling at the buttons, I finally succumbed to sweet relief, soaking the plush rug beneath my feet, along with my socks, underwear, and those wretched pants still buckled around my waist. Some days when I'm standing in front of a toilet, I can still feel that rug beneath my feet, a moist phantom of my earliest humiliation. I spent the next 20 minutes silently brooding in that bathroom. They were black pants, after all. Maybe I could get away with acting like this hadn't happened. All I needed to do was spend the next 2 to 3 hours in damp agony, and as long as nobody looked too closely or inhaled too deeply, I could escape undetected. But I spent too long plotting this out, and Kenny's mom knocked on the door. "Is everything all right in there?" A question that someone only asks when everything is not all right in there. I confess to the accident and open the door in surrender. I thought for a moment maybe she'd stick my nose in it, the way my mother used to stick our dog's nose in his pee when he pissed where he wasn't supposed to. But she took the carpet from beneath me and handed me a pair of Kenny's old shorts to wear for the rest of our playdate, my very own scarlet letter, so that all could bear witness to my shame. That evening, I left Kenny's house in those shame shorts, carrying my own clothes in a plastic bag, with my head held high, just as Hester walked with her letter before me. I couldn't help but think that I somehow deserved what happened. Earlier that day, my schoolmates and I were eating lunch in our classroom. The gymnasium we'd normally eat in was closed for the assembly, so we were eating at our desks instead, which felt intoxicating, like we were doing something forbidden. Everybody was already hopped up on assembly energy, but now we were especially animated, fidgeting in our seats, screaming across the room, tossing bits of food when the teacher turned her back. Austin was the boy who sat behind me, a huge lug of a kid, nearly twice as tall as the rest of us and almost twice as thick. If this were a fairy tale, Austin would be the ogre child we'd all run from when he emerged from his swamp. And I'd feel bad about the comparison, but Austin was kind of an asshole, one of those boys who was friendly only until someone better came along, so I treated him with similar respect. We were drinking from our cartons of milk, those tiny paper boxes that are nearly impossible to open, made of that kind of thin cardboard that gets immediately soggy after the first few sips. Austin was halfway through a long sip when I turned around and made a funny face. My repertoire of humor in first grade was limited to gurgling noises, knock-knock jokes, and funny faces. And he choked back a mouthful of spittle and milk with a furious scowl. "Don't!" he screamed with genuine anger. "These are my nice pants! I can't ruin them!" This made me laugh even harder. Each time he'd pick up his carton, I'd turn around with my fingers halfway up my nose, my cheeks puffed out, my eyes crossed, and Austin would cry back, "Stop! If I get milk on my pants, my mom's gonna kill me!" It went on like this for 10 minutes, back and forth, attracting a small audience around us, eagerly waiting to see if Austin would ever finish his milk. Until finally, I waited for him to take the largest possible gulp. I turned around at just the right moment with just the right combination of fingers stuffed into the right combination of face holes. Austin lurched forward for a moment to try to stop himself from reacting, and then, all at once, a violent stream of milk exploded from his nose, all down his sweater, and pooled momentarily in his pants before seeping into the fabric. The audience around us erupted in screams of laughter, and Austin's own outburst turned from a milky chortle to anguish as he stomped away from us, wailing in protest. There are a few lessons to draw here, the first of which, of course, is that children are terrible human beings, and I was certainly no exception. Though, in my defense, Austin grew up to be an even bigger dick and once said, "I'm fat, but at least I'm not fat and gay like Matt Bellassai, so I don't regret ruining his dumb pants, and if I could, I'd go back, do it all again, and then smash his stupid face into that puddle of snotty lap milk before it seeped onto his tiny ogre dick." Most significantly, though, this was the first time I realized that comedy could be weaponized. I might not have been the fastest or strongest, but I could spin a joke or pull a face and bring an oafish menace like Austin to his knees. And yes, perhaps I'd have to make myself look like a fool for the sake of a laugh, but at least it was my laugh in the end, even if I ended the day in a pair of someone else's shorts, carrying my own soiled pants and underwear in a plastic baggie. I'm not one of those cool New Yorkers who lunched with Nora Ephron, but I like to pretend that I am. I imagine we would have sat for hours at a cafe drinking coffees, ordering extra croissants when we'd finished the two we'd already eaten, and smearing them with extra high-fat butter. We'd have been wearing matching turtlenecks and scarves, discussing which wrinkle-reducing eye creams we'd discovered most recently, or which new dessert shop we would try next, or perhaps, after the sixth croissant, whether Angelina Jolie would ever find love again. I moved to the Upper West Side in part because I idolized Nora's rendition of it. My studio was only a closet compared to the apartments in the Apthorpe, the famous complex down the street where Nora lived for some time, but still I felt peppy and witty and sophisticated whenever I walked those streets, like a character in one of her movies, waiting for a young, hot Tom Hanks to reach for the same muffin as me at the bakery before sweeping me off my feet and paying off all of my student loan bills. It made my measly New York existence, my piles of takeout containers stacked in the corner, my bathroom without a bathroom door, the stench of burning meats that wrestled its way through the walls from the apartment next door, feel all the more like I was living the life of a scintillating two-time divorcee, a true woman of the city. More important, though, living like Nora made it all the easier to find the humor in all those terrible New York moments. Discovering mold on the bottom of a breakfast sandwich I'd already half-eaten, falling down an entire subway staircase, dropping an entire container of hot food I'd carefully selected the second I stepped out of the Whole Foods in Union Square. "Everything is copy," Nora recalls her mother repeating, which she interpreted as a sort of battle cry. "When you slip on a banana peel, people laugh at you," she wrote of her mother's quote. "But when you tell people you slipped on a banana peel, it's your laugh. So you become the hero rather than the victim of the joke." What follows in this book is a collection of all of my banana-slipping moments, retold here so that I may, perhaps, be the hero and not the victim of my plentiful embarrassments. Consider it a retelling of life's little indignities, all the times I've stood in front of a toilet, desperately grasping at the buttons of my big boy pants, when everything goes utterly awry, however cosmically deserved. This book is my baggie full of pee pants, and I hold it high as the urine-stained hero. On Being an Adult, or I Have No Idea What I'm Doing. I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. Like, at all. This morning alone, I hit the snooze button no less than 13 times before getting out of bed, and let's be real, I only really gave in because I had to pee, and I figured pissing my sheets would be more trouble than it was worth on a Tuesday afternoon. And yes, before you ask, I have in fact considered peeing my bed rather than standing up and walking 15 feet to use the toilet, and the day I decide doing laundry is less work than walking to the bathroom is the day we're all in a hell of a lot of trouble. And sure, I managed to put on sweatpants and walk to the deli across the street to order a breakfast sandwich, a muffin, and a chocolate milk, but only before I dragged it all back to my apartment, climbed back into bed, and stuffed it all in my face seconds before falling back asleep for another 3.5 hours. This, my friends, is what I consider a productive day. Here is my truth. I'm Matt. I'm 26, and I'm terrible at being a functioning, self-sufficient, adult member of society. If they gave out awards for being bad at growing up, like most likely to eat a frozen dinner that's still frozen because he couldn't wait the full 4 minutes for the microwave to finish, I probably would have won a whole bunch of them by now. But then again, they'd probably make me show up somewhere to accept them, and then I'd have to shower and put on deodorant and probably wear a bow tie and cufflinks, and the thought of doing just one of those things is exhausting enough. Also, I don't even know how to tie a bow tie, and I don't really know what cufflinks are supposed to do, so my talent for being horrible at adulthood would probably go unrecognized forever. Unless they send me the award in the mail, in which case I'll totally accept it, but only if I don't have to sign for the package because I don't like opening the door for the UPS man since he's usually unreasonably attractive and my eyes are usually still boogered shut from sleeping until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But I'll absolutely pick it up from the doorway once he leaves. But I've gotten ahead of myself, which is the thing that tends to happen when you have no idea what you're doing and also you're trying to write a whole fucking book. Apparently, writing a book takes a very long time, and it's not something you can just wait and do the night before it's due, no matter how often it worked in college, because a book is a whole lot longer than those papers you wrote in college, and also nobody is spending money to buy your college paper from the bargain bin at Target, which is where I assume everybody will buy this book. Phew. Okay, where was I? Oh, yes. The truth is, I'm very bad at growing up, and I always have been. And, like all problems in life, it's most likely my family's fault, or at least, it's easiest to just blame it all on them. Like many babies, I was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck. And I don't technically blame my mother outright, but I do have questions. Sure, it's a perfectly normal thing that happens during labor, it happens in something like 1 in 3 childbirths, and most people don't even think twice about it. But in my case, I can't help but wonder whether on some subconscious level, my mother's body knew exactly what it was doing and simply refused to let go, intent on keeping me in the womb until I became an elderly man and died. Or worse, it was trying to kill me before I had a chance to grow up and write a book that painted her as some kind of overprotective Gestapo. Whatever the reason, I survived the attack, blue-faced and bloated, able to breathe on my own. And that was perhaps the first and only time I did anything by myself. I went on to spend an inordinate amount of my childhood bashfully attached to my mother's pelvis, mostly out of social anxiety, but also because I was raised from an early age to fear anything that posed even the mildest of threats. In my mother's worldview, no danger was too small or insignificant to ignore, and my older brother and I were taught to mistrust basically anything that spoke, breathed, or moved. Riding bikes outside the driveway was a surefire way to end up as roadkill, and roadkill was a surefire way to catch salmonella, or rabies, or whatever diseases raccoons carried, which we were to safely assume was every disease. Pools of water deeper than puddles were traps sent from heaven to claim little angels. A child can drown in an inch of water, my mother would often yell. An inch! And don't even get her started on public parks. Sure, go ahead. Go to the park. Have fun spending the rest of your life cooking meth with the other kids in some guy named Burl's basement. I bet he won't make you a birthday lasagna. In retrospect, I think it's quite possible my mother kept me purposefully fat and lazy to make me less attractive to abductors. Go ahead. Try stealing my flabby baby boy. Good luck getting him to do shit for you, though. Feeding him alone will cost you a fortune. And so I grew up thinking every activity was brimming with peril. To Debbie, letting a child onto a trampoline was no less dangerous than arming him with a loaded, semi-automatic pistol. A water gun that fired anything more than a sprinkle was the quickest way to lose both eyes. And snow days were not days of glory and amusement, because glory and amusement equaled extremities lost to frostbite. If the snow is too dangerous for you to go to school in, she told us, then it's definitely too dangerous to play in. Now, my mother was by no means a doomsayer who forced us to live in some bunker and bide our time until the nuclear apocalypse burnt us all to hell, though we did stock up on canned goods before Y2K, but that was just common sense. In fact, my mother freely encouraged us to go outside, as long as we stayed within 6 to 10 inches of the front door at all times, and we were given all the trappings of Midwestern suburban kid life, like scooters, big wheels, pogo sticks, and skateboards, and we could do anything we wanted with them, as long as anything didn't include riding, jumping, running, brisk walking, or moving. I know, of course, that all of this worrying came only from a place of love. My mother likes to remind me that I was a miracle baby because her uterus had been almost entirely removed before she became pregnant with me, and doctors told her that the likelihood of conceiving another child was basically next to impossible. Which is all to say that I was not a miracle, but what they call a big, fat accident. But still, I was her precious baby boy handed to her by Jesus himself. I grew up, in other words, being what psychiatrists might later diagnose as hopelessly coddled into emotional and physical dependency, which is just fancy talk for love too much and fucked up because of it. By the time I was old enough to go to preschool, I'd already become so terrified of the grown-up world that I literally refused to get out of the car on the first day of school. When my mother came around the car to open the door for me, I'd scurried up to the driver's seat, locked all the doors, and sat steadfast in nonviolent protest. If I'd had the stamina, I would still be there today. They managed eventually to lure me out with the promise of sugar and gifts, but once we were inside, I refused to be put down and dug into the thick of my mother's arm while 3 grown adults attempted to peel me from her. This happened every morning for the first week of preschool until they finally broke me. Of course, I can't entirely blame my mother for teaching me to fear the world, in part because she will read this book, and if she's made it this far, I'm sure she's already pissed, and I have no doubt she's already plotting her own revenge memoir just to publish every embarrassing detail of my entire existence in excruciating specificity. But also, I have to be fair, because Michael Jackson is also to blame. Now, I know what you're thinking, and no, I never had to go to court and point at a doll, and I'm almost positive I've never been to Neverland Ranch, but Michael Jackson ruined my childhood nonetheless. Let me explain. When I was somewhere around 2 or 3 years old, I was minding my own business, probably playing with my Mr. Potato Head in peace, when Michael Jackson's Thriller came on the television. This was 1993. It had been a full decade since Thriller was first released, but they only showed 3 things on TV in the 90s. The Oprah Winfrey Show, TV shows about black teenagers going to live with their aunties and uncles in Bel Air, and 13-minute-long music videos. And Thriller fell into at least 2 of those categories. For whatever reason, my mother thought it would be a good idea for me, her 3-year-old infant baby child, to see this video with my own 2 innocent baby eyes. She beckoned me over from Mr. Potato Head and innocently said, "Look, Matthew, watch the man turn into a big doggy." She figured, I guess, that I was 3 and my interest included dogs, bright jackets, and effeminate men, so maybe I'd enjoy watching Michael Jackson turn into what she affectionately believed to be a large, kind puppy. Of course, if you've seen Michael Jackson's Thriller, you know that this is a wild mischaracterization of what happens in the video. Dogs are friendly and they are nice and they lick your face. Michael Jackson does not turn into a dog. Michael Jackson turns into a jagged-fanged, yellow-eyed, contorted-faced werewolf who literally rips a girl to shreds. And my mother made me watch that shit. The second his eyes turned into angry yellow slits, I screamed like he had personally burst through our front door and I leapt headfirst into my mother's uterus, or what was left of it, refusing to reemerge for nearly 3 days. Some nights, I close my eyes, and I still see his face. And perhaps I would have forgotten this event had it not been for my brother, who purchased a rubber werewolf mask days later just to chase me around the house while I screamed for mercy. To make matters even worse, not long after this, my older cousin Nick tried to scare me into obedience with a story about a clown named Pennywise who stole insubordinate children in their sleep and forced them to work in underground labor camps. It didn't matter that this was merely a bastardized version of a Stephen King novel. I believed it outright, and spent 4 straight nights without sleep, shaking uncontrollably, fearful that closing my eyes guaranteed my immediate kidnapping. This is all to say that I entered adolescence scarred not just by my mother, but also by my brother, my cousin, Pennywise the child-stealing clown, and Michael Jackson himself. It should be no surprise that I'm fucked up. I spent most of my early childhood fully expecting every person I met to transform into a wild-eyed beast who would kill me in my sleep if they could get to me before the clown forced me into hard labor. Eventually, of course, I grew up, and those fears went away. But the fun thing about fears is that they're easily replaced with a bunch of new fears that are just as believable and overwhelming. Don't drive a car faster than 10 miles per hour because you will crash, and we won't even be able to identify your body. Don't drink alcohol before you're 21, or your liver will tell your brain to become an alcoholic, and you'll spend the rest of your life in rehab where they don't even get all the TV channels. Don't get on airplanes because airplanes are the number one travel method of terrorists, and if the terrorists don't kill you, it doesn't even matter because the plane is going to crash on its own anyway. It's a miracle I make it outside of the house at all. So here we are. I'm now 26, which is the age at which people start to assess whether you have your shit together, or at least whether you have the mental and physical capacity for one day getting your shit together. It's the age at which people start categorizing your laziness as less of an endearing quirk and more of a problem the government will have to solve one day. It's when people start to wonder how long you really have before shit goes entirely off the rails and you end up as one of those people on the evening news who managed to live unnoticed in the basement of a Staten Island Burger King. And when the reporter asks you why you've been living down here all these years, you ramble about trampolines and snow days and Michael Jackson and a demon clown. It's the age at which you should know what the fuck you're doing, regardless of how much the world fucked you up. And yet, I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. I don't date, I don't drive, I don't eat right, I don't exercise, I don't cook, I don't clean, I don't know how to dress myself, and I can't remember where I left my remote, which should be the least of my concerns, but somehow it's the most upsetting. Now, I know what you're thinking. Matt, none of us know what the fuck we're doing with our lives, and all of us have problems, and we're all just meaningless sacks of meat, wandering aimlessly around a rock that's hurtling through space, and eventually, that rock will slam into the sun, and the universe will explode, and none of this will mean a damn thing. Which is true, but also, I can't help but feel like the Italian boy behind the bodega counter is judging me every time I show up at 3 in the morning to buy a pint of mint chocolate chip gelato. He doesn't seem to care that the sun is going to melt the earth one day. All he seems to care about is that I only need one plastic spoon and no bag because he knows I'm popping the lid off this thing the second I walk out the door. So yes, I have no idea what I'm doing. Today, I went outside, I ate a sandwich and a muffin, I drank a chocolate milk, I took a long nap, and it was a productive day. On the trauma of having, or not having, hair. I was born with a freakish amount of hair, or so they tell me. I don't really like to talk about the day I was born because it's the first and only time I touched a vagina, and I like to pretend I have a clean record. And yes, technically my picture got taken right after I slid out, but you can't really tell how much hair a baby has from a picture taken seconds after it emerges from amniotic juices. Based on the sole surviving photograph I have of that day, whatever hair I had was caked in what looks like thick strawberry jam, except it wasn't strawberry jam, it was bits of placenta, because they don't even dry you all the way off before they snap the picture that will one day end up on your birthday cakes. They should really wait until the placenta dries and flakes off before they take the picture. So no, I don't know exactly how much hair I had when I was born, but my mother likes to brag that I had a lot of it, which is kind of a weird thing to gloat about, if you ask me. I don't like seeing a single strand of hair on my dinner plate. I can't imagine an entire ball of it growing in my uterus for 9 months and emerging from my body, sentient and screaming for food, and then being like, yeah, I made that, and now I'm going to let it live in my house for 20 years. In fact, in 8th grade health class, that most sacred of American public school institutions, wherein children are first informed that hair will start growing from places previously unheard of in life, I distinctly remember watching The Miracle of Birth, a horrid documentary in which a Wisconsin woman with a bad perm is freed of an alien that's been swelling in her abdomen. It astounds me to this day that we force 13-year-olds to watch a woman giving birth on VHS tape and consider this sexual education. I barely even knew what a vagina looked like on a regular day, let alone the day a screaming mass of hair decides to claw out of it. But that's not the point. The point is, I had to watch that mess. And I remember viscerally gagging during the scene when it happens, not because of the miracle of it all, but because of the sheer amount of hair that's involved in the whole thing. Babies are covered in it. Vaginas are covered in it. I tried to avoid looking at it straight on by peering above my glasses and letting my blurry vision dull my ability to see what was happening, but I still remember, fuzzy eyesight be damned, the angry, throbbing ball of fur emerging from between that screaming woman's legs. It was like watching a ball of rats crawl through the hole of a sewer drain during a mudslide. To make matters worse, my health teacher, who also happened to be my gym teacher, my history teacher, and the football coach, because American public schools are masters of efficiency, was a widower whose wife died in childbirth because, by some freak medical anomaly, a hair got into her bloodstream and she was in labor and murdered her to death. I'm not making this up. The bulk of my sexual education came from a man whose life was literally ruined by hair. And that's not even mentioning the pictures of hairy, gonorrhea-stricken genitals he showed us on the first day of class. I guess my mother didn't know that hair kills. Or maybe she was happy simply knowing that my hairy ass didn't murder her on the way out, because she still talks about walking down the hospital hallway to the tiny deli counter they keep the babies in and being able to spot me right away, my wispy ginger hair blowing in the wind. Little did she know that wispy ginger hair would go on to ruin my life. This may go without saying, but I don't like hair. Hair is disgusting and a generally terrible inconvenience. It collects grease and dirt and particles of old crusty food. It gathers in clumps, a unit of measurement that has never been used to describe anything good in this world. You know what else gathers in clumps? Herpes. It clogs my shower drain. It mixes with toothpaste to congeal on the sides of my sink. It piles up in thickets beneath my furniture and comes scurrying out like tumbleweeds the second I have someone over. And let's be real, it's far outlasted its evolutionary purpose. Cavemen needed hair to keep warm and, I can only imagine, given their relative abundance of free time, to have something to aimlessly braid between hump sessions. But let's face it, I have central heating and the internet, so whatever value hair added to the cave people's lives seems to have been generally satisfied. Apparently, anthropologists think humans lost our cave hair when we gained the ability to walk on two legs and needed to better regulate our body temperatures for long-distance runs. Considering I have never, and will never, run any long distances in my life, once again, hair's purpose is unnecessary. Worst of all, hair is needy. My hair has never been longer than a few inches, and yet, I've used approximately every product ever made in the entirety of history to attempt to wield power over it, a list that grows every year as they invent new ways to get me to spend my money on chemicals. In the 90s, there was just gel, mousse, or hairspray, and you put it on your frosted tips, and that was the end of it. But now, hell has expanded, and there are pastes, pomades, waxes, putties, glues, clays, creams, and cremes, difference unclear, lotions, oils, exfoliating scalp treatments, grooming serums, and, I'm not fucking around with you on this one, quicksand. And we haven't even gotten to the endless varieties of conditioners, the function of which I still don't entirely understand, and shampoos, which you can now apparently use in dry form, a luxury I refuse to believe actually works. And this is just the hair on your head. There are the creams, foams, and tonics you're supposed to use before you shave, and the moisturizers, oils, and lotions you're supposed to use after you shave. And of course, you have to get a shaver, or actually two shavers, unless you want to shave the hair around your mouth with the same instrument you use to shave the hair around your testicles. Oh, and also one of those weird-shaped shavers that go up your nostrils and inside your ears, and possibly one of those contraptions you can use to shave the hair on your back. And tweezers for everything in between. And despite all of this, my hair still looks like it belongs on the head of a politician who tries to solicit sex in an airport bathroom. Oh, and don't even get me started on the TSA's crusade against hair products on airplanes. What havoc could I possibly wreak on an airplane with a bottle of Ultra Firm holding spray? Answer me that, TSA people! You know who had awful hair? Osama bin Laden. By making me throw away my conditioner, you're just playing into his master plan. This is what he wanted. In fairness, I am a man, and my struggle with hair is but a fraction of the battle that women are expected to wage daily. My haircuts cost less than a McDonald's value meal, and theoretically, I could just decide to stop caring about it one day, and everybody would assume I was preparing for my breakout role as guy who sniffs paint behind a Denny's. And of course, as a white guy, my hair carries none of the cultural baggage that people of color reckon with every day. Nobody has tried to reach out and touch my hair on the train, and generally speaking, nobody has questioned how often I wash it. All things considered, I have it relatively easy. But still, I don't like hair. I don't like the hair on my head, or the hair in my armpits, or the hair that grows in all the other places that hair has absolutely no reason growing other than to serve as itchy, sweaty decoration. I hate that I have to wash it, and condition it, and cut it, and style it, and make sure there are no bugs making babies in it. I hate that I can't get rid of it because my skull is the shape of a peeled yam and my skin is oily, and if I went fully bald, my scalp would look like an angry jack-o'-lantern. I hate that I have to brush it every time I leave my apartment because I look like I'm plotting to steal Christmas if I don't. And I hate that it has the audacity to make me care for it, to grow it and water it and pet it every day for almost 3 loving decades, and now it's finally deciding to go away, strand by strand, and refusing to come back. Perhaps it finally caught on to the fact that I don't like it very much, and made the unilateral decision to abandon me en masse. But that's typical hair behavior. It gives you hell and demands it all, and then leaves the second you start getting used to it. My dependency on hair started before I can even remember. I was born with the comb-over of a televangelist, and forces beyond my control decided to make this the only haircut that would ever work with my body type and facial features, long before I could possibly have any say in the matter. For one disastrous week in 1999, I attempted to take matters into my own hands and experimented with the center part, and my entire life nearly fell to pieces. The order of the universe continues to depend on my hair being parted in the same spot it was first parted by Moses himself, which is exactly 30% across my scalp from left to right. Every morning of my childhood, for as long as I can remember, I would run up to my mother with a long comb and a spray bottle full of water. She would wet my hair until I could feel the tiny droplets dripping down my temples and then part it in 2 or 3 short strokes, always in the same spot. Then, while it was still damp, she would pick up an oversized aerosol can and thoroughly douse my head in a gallon of Megahold hairspray until my hair turned into virtual stone. I spent most of my adolescence with the shiny, immovable hair of a pinstriped 80s stockbroker. In almost every picture of me as a child, it's almost impossible to tell I had ginger hair at all because it was covered in so much product it looked like the color of wet clay and had the stiffness of titanium. And it soon became part of my public identity. Classmates would gather around me on the playground during recess and take turns knocking on my hair like they were knocking on a slab of concrete. On weekends, the local blacksmith would come to our house and use my hair to forge wrought iron into various decorative metal fixtures. And I once won a battering contest against a very formidable ram. Of course, as with any well-publicized strength, vulnerabilities were right around the corner. And my enemies knew this well. My brother, who is 6 years older than I am, had plenty of time to reckon with his hair journey long before I came along. A true child of the 90s, he was far more adventurous with using hair as a form of expressing inner angst, and cycled through countless iterations of spikes, colored tips, and bleaches, including a brief foray into pink hair dye that nearly tore our family apart. He insisted on dyeing his hair the color of chewed bubblegum. Mom and Dad insisted that any such action was akin to joining one of those cults where you have to drown a kitten to get in. He did it anyway. My parents had to kill a cat just to prove their point. Now, many years later, he's given up on taming his hair entirely, opting instead for a shaggy, unkempt mop and an unwieldy beard. He looks very much like the kind of person who goes hunting for game with his bare hands and has bitten directly into a still-beating deer heart. In many ways, the disparity in our hair choices is emblematic of the differences we exhibited more broadly. He preferred the more rebellious, Hot Topic-inspired way of life, and I preferred the more genteel lifestyle of a door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman. To say we did not particularly mesh would be an understatement, and yet I insisted on being included in whatever activities he partook in, per my contractual duties as younger sibling. When he inevitably exploded, which was often, I was very annoying. No retaliatory target was as appealing as my hair. It was, after all, the thing I seemingly cared most about, and representative of my general stodginess and infuriating nature. If I were a terrorist, looking to inflict the most symbolic damage on my annoying 8-year-old self, I would have chosen my hair, too. By then, I'd learned how to wet it, comb it, and spray it myself, and spent a considerable amount of time in the bathroom every morning getting every strand just right so as to be best prepared for my daily regimen of aggressive pestering. My hair was precious to me. I don't remember what I did to piss him off this particular time. We were outside in the middle of summer. I might have taken his bike or stepped on his foot or sprayed his back too many times with the water gun I'd gotten for my birthday, but whatever it was, it sent him into a wild-eyed rage. He came at me, I screamed at an octave only birds could hear, he grabbed me by the shoulders, and taking a deep breath, spit the wad of chewing gum he'd been chomping on directly onto my scalp. Now you'd think, given the amount of hairspray I'd covered it with, that my hair would have been protected by a sort of chemical force field, that the gum would have hit the hard surface and bounced right off, and I'd have been free to continue my pestering, emboldened by my brother's failed revenge plot. But you'd be fucking wrong, because of course it didn't bounce right off. It fucking stuck, because that's what gum does. I figured at first that if it had stuck only lightly, I could reach in and pluck it right out, like picking a grape out of a shag carpet. This is the best metaphor I could think of, and I'm sorry. Backup options included, like fetching a hard-boiled egg from a patch of weeds, and like fishing a piece of orange chicken from a pile of hay. Naturally, my attempts to pick it out merely exacerbated the situation, and I ran, wailing, to my mother, whose own attempts proved even less effective, perhaps because my body was convulsing in dramatic sobs as her fingers spread the gum into more and more clumps. If you've ever tried cleaning shit out of a dog's ass hair, you know exactly what we're dealing with here. Every time you try to wipe, the dog moves, and the shit somehow multiplies until it has spread into a far larger, even shittier patch of destruction. I'm sure there are plenty of mommy bloggers today who know the exact mixture of peanut butter, vegetable oil, and angel tears you need to get gum out of a kid's hair without resorting to the nuclear option, but this was 1998, and all we had was a dial-up connection. We weren't about to wait 30 minutes for the computer to connect to the internet so we could figure out how to get gum out of hair the fancy way. So, having protested that I would rather live with the mangled, patchy hairstyle of an off-brand clown than shave it all off, my mother proceeded to perform spot surgery and literally hacked the gum from my head until every sticky trace had been excised. We spent the next several days traveling from one suburban supercuts to another. At every stop, my mother would spin me around, point to the spot where she'd taken an axe to my skull, and look expectantly at each stylist to see who could conjure enough magic to make me whole again. But the desecration had been too deep, my crown had been broken, and there was no fixing the damage that had been inflicted on my soul. It probably grew back in like a week, because kids' hair grows like mold on old bread, but I learned a valuable lesson that day. Hair can never be trusted, no matter how religiously you wash it, condition it, wet it, part it, and hairspray it. The second it gets the chance, it'll gleefully ruin your entire goddamn life. One chopped gummy patch at a time. As I got older, and the children who once knocked on my hardened hair grew into judgmental teenagers eager to pounce on anything even slightly unordinary, I abandoned my hairspray in favor of the more relaxed, no-frills vibe of a 13-year-old with split ends. Which is to say, I spent most of high school with hair that had the consistency of straw because it had been blow-dried to within an inch of its life every single morning. But it worked for me. Of course, my hair, knowing full well that I'd found some sense of equilibrium in life, couldn't let well enough alone and began conspiring with my hormones to bring life new hellish meaning. Hair began appearing in places it had never been before, bringing with it fresh new odors and itchiness and discomfort. As a Belisai, I'm at the end of a long line of Italian men and women with body hair thicker than lush forest moss. I used to lie awake at night and wonder why we couldn't have turned out like the oiled, hairless men in the Dolce & Gabbana ads. I'm sure they never had to shave their necks beneath the collars of their shirts, or tweeze obsessively between their eyebrows, or brush the fur on their toe knuckles. I bet their shower drains didn't look like they were trying to flush the decaying carcass of a trampled wildebeest. When my father took off his shirt, it looked like he'd covered himself in glue and rolled around the floor of a veterinarian's office. I used to wonder how he ever fully dried himself off after swimming in the pool. And this is what I inherited. My hair didn't grow normally, though. The hair on my face didn't all decide to arrive at once, at the same even length. It grew one at a time, starting with one very ambitious strand that grew from the dead center of my cheek and coiled before I'd noticed it. It was long enough that a girl at school reached out and physically plucked it from my face before she said, "Aw, look who's becoming a man." An event that continues to haunt me to this day, but mostly because she had no idea if maybe I wanted to keep that whisker as a souvenir, or if I'd been growing it out as an experiment. When I eventually had hair to shave, I pressed way too hard with the electric shaver and had my first lesson in the searing pain of razor burn, which is just another one of hair's backhanded gifts. Hair ushers you into adulthood, welcomes you with the new responsibilities of maturity, and then, when you finally muster the competence to deal with it, takes a layer of your skin clean off on its way out. Sometime around my 22nd birthday was when I first realized that the hair on my head was beginning to thin. I noticed it, as you notice most things in life, in the reflection of my head on the blank screen of my phone. At first, I thought it might just be the angle. Nobody looks like they have much hair when they're looking at themselves from beneath a triple chin. But when I brought up my grip, I saw that the hair at the front of my head seemed just a little less thick than usual. My hair had always been thick, thick enough that the stylist at Supercuts was forced to use thinning shears just to work with it. But perhaps because of the amount of chemicals I'd put in my hair since birth, or the aggressive way I combed it every morning, or my general lack of a healthy diet and exercise regimen, but probably not, it was undoubtedly starting to grow thinner. My mother blamed the woman at Supercuts for her indiscriminate use of the thinning shears, but I suspect she was just angry I'd started going to a salon rather than have her cut my hair in the laundry room with the same scissors she used to groom the dog, and was looking for a reason to prove me wrong. She had cut my hair until I was nearly 20 years old, and the betrayal she felt when I finally announced I'd be going to a strip mall beauty parlor reverberated for months. She still blames those Supercuts thinning shears for my receding hairline, despite the fact that it's receding in the same fashion as my father's and his father's before him in what some might call a pattern of male baldness. It's been a handful of years since then, and I'm glad to say that I still have a fair amount of hair on my head and, for the curious, a thriving amount of hair everywhere else. But here is hair's final twist of the knife. I'm now an adult gay man, at a point when hair is of premium importance in life. After all, in the gay community, for better or worse, hair defines everything. It is virtually the single most ubiquitous characteristic in the gay taxonomy. There are twinks, bears, otters, cubs, wolves, all defined one way or another by the presence or lack of hair. And I fit neatly into none of those categories, which means if I ever do porn, they won't even know what part of the website to put me in. For the record, if I had to categorize myself, I probably most closely resemble a bear, but like Paddington, because I always keep my clothes on, so the porn thing will have to be artsy, like for guys who get off on watching other guys eat meatball sandwiches. The gay community has had a long obsession with grooming, and for many, a proper professional gay needs to be waxed, shaved, and styled to perfection all before getting out of bed. Beards, which are now the defining symbol of gay hotness, should be trimmed and shaped to emulate no less than the Spartans themselves. And of course, manscaping is an absolute must, and body hair of any kind should be expunged besides perfect decorative topiaries above the genitals, beneath the armpits, and along the arms. Failure to meet any of these specifications will result in the immediate destruction of one's gay card. So now, with a mop of thinning ginger fur, I must endure hair's latest streak of sabotage. It wasn't enough to plague me through childhood, to cast a dark and itchy shadow over puberty, or to bring home bugs that one time we went swimming in an unfamiliar lake. It looms over me still, now armed with the sharpened knife of the gaze piercing judgment, staring back at me in the mirror every morning with an ever wispier glare. Maybe I'll just wear wigs. On being the big guy. I first discovered I was fat the day I no longer fit beneath the bed. I was playing hide and seek, and this was my go-to spot, mostly because it was dark and quiet, and I could pick at the fuzzies that dangled from the bottom of the box spring. But this day, I couldn't quite squeeze my stomach beneath the metal frame. To be fair, my family had very thick carpeting and very short bed frames, so the space between bed and floor was very difficult to squeeze into to begin with. But still, one day I fit, and the next day, I didn't. It's a harsh way for a kid to discover he's fat, especially when there's a kid in the next room counting down from 10, which is a really short amount of time to both process your newfound fatness and also find another equally sufficient hiding spot. There should really be a hide-and-seek rule for a scenario like this. Like, the hiding countdown may be extended from 10 seconds to 25 years in the event of an existential crisis of the body. Adjust accordingly, and may God have mercy on your portly soul. But let's face it, the rules of hide-and-seek were never that solid to begin with. In my parents' eyes, I was never fat. I was just a growing boy with a healthy appetite who needed to eat whatever he wanted in order to grow big and strong. Never mind that I went up 3 pant sizes each year, or that I could barely run across the backyard without suffering severe stomach cramps, or that I was developing my own petite little boy breasts. This is what happened to all little boys. We'd grow into it, the logic went. For now, eat your burgers and fries, read protein and vegetables, because little boys need all the nutrients they can get. You can pinpoint the year I got fat by looking at my school pictures. You can clearly see the year my metabolism realized it was in for a lifetime of grueling hard work and gave the fuck up. In first grade, I had discernible cheekbones and the hint of a jawline. By second grade, puffy red cheeks and the beginnings of a double chin. The thing is, I've always loved to eat. I mean, yes, technically everybody likes to eat. We're sort of biologically engineered to like it or we die. I just happen to like eating beyond the point where eating was necessary for survival and into the point where you're only stuffing your face with cold mac and cheese because there's nothing better to do at 3 in the morning on a Tuesday. It didn't help that I was also generally averse to any and all types of physical activity and preferred watching reruns of Three's Company with a bag of potato chips indoors over running around with the neighborhood kids outside. My family never had an unhealthy relationship with food, but we weren't exactly the picturesque vision of American vigor. We're Midwesterners, which means we liked food, and we ate it more than we did anything else. Sure, we never had the best diets, but never for lack of trying. We ate our vegetables if eat your vegetables meant eat your gravy-covered mashed potatoes and broccoli casserole. We ate healthy snacks if healthy snacks included a heaping bowl of sugary breakfast cereal as a midnight treat before bedtime. And we sustained consistent, stable diets if consistency included being regulars at the local Dairy Queen. Seriously, we would walk into that place and leave with extra large brownie blizzards without having to say a single word. Plus, our diets were economical. Whenever Oreos were on sale at the grocery store, my mom stocked up like we were preparing for the zombie apocalypse, and the only means of survival was hidden between layers of cookies and cream. We also weren't a particularly active family, and the activities we did participate in usually revolved around food. The year McDonald's released those Beanie Baby Happy Meal toys, my mom drove us to every McDonald's franchise in the greater Chicago area until we tracked down every last piece of garbage Beanie Baby in the set. Maybe we didn't have problems with food, but we did have problems with Beanie Babies. And yes, obviously, we ordered Happy Meals at every stop, but only because you had to order the meal in order to get the toys. Still, we ended up with enough burgers to last for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the next 3 years. Meanwhile, I was aware I was growing larger, and I felt inferior because of it. My brother, chastised for the litany of insults and taunts he frequently lobbed my way, resorted instead to calling me Big Guy, which was, technically speaking, not actually an insult like Fatso or Tubby, but a fairly benign and accurate description of my growing frame. "Nice one, Big Guy," he'd say whenever he wanted to see me angry. "Having a snack there, Big Guy?" And I'd stomp my chubby feet and blow air through my nose and demand that my mom made him call me something less insulting, like Four Eyes or Baby Hitler. It didn't help, though, that he was right. I was big and getting bigger. In the winter of 1999, my brother and I went sledding on the hill across the street from our house. I squeezed into the pair of overall snow pants I'd worn the year before, except this year, it felt like a corset. I could barely fasten the zipper along my bust and stomach. I could feel my lungs straining against my gallbladder. I managed to cover myself securely enough, but the second we got outside, I bent over to position my sled, and those snow pants ripped open along the butt with a deafening tear. The white stuffing from inside the pants gushed out like I was shitting dust. "Good going, Big Guy," my brother yelled as I ran back to the house, covering my gaping ass in humiliation. It wasn't until high school that I began to feel serious shame for my weight, beyond the boyish taunts of childhood. By that time, I'd started to succumb to all the usual changes that plague young high school boys. Things were reshaping, hair was growing, limbs were extending, and high school was when I joined the rest of adult America and started taking antidepressants, which made my fleshy man boobs even fleshier, which is a legitimate and cruel side effect of antidepressants. Oh, you're feeling sad because you're growing up all chubby? Here, take some meds that'll make you need a man bra. Until then, of course, I could hide my girth beneath a heavy t-shirt or a jacket. The only people who had seen my bare stomach or thighs were my family, and even then, I'd kept my weight as concealed as I could. But high school locker rooms are where insecurities go to be exposed. It was the first time I could see the raw evidence of my body compared to other boys, how my stomach, which hung just slightly over the seam of my underwear, was nowhere near as flat or as toned as everyone else's, that my muscles, or whatever there was of them, were hidden beneath a doughy layer of padding, that my thighs jiggled slightly more, and that I needed a thicker t-shirt. It's also the first time I started noticing men's bodies as more than just bodies, but as objects of desire. Young gay kids are plagued with the dual struggle of wanting to be with the bodies that haunt us and wanting to be like them. Those desires often irrevocably tangled up in one another. I didn't know if I was watching the other shirtless boys because I wanted to look like them, or because I liked the way they looked, or both. I didn't know if the shame I felt was about my own body or my own desires. And the confusion made it all not worth thinking about at all. And so, I ignored my own body. I ignored its growing size. I ignored that the food I was eating was related to the rate my body was expanding. And so, I brought my weight and its baggage to college, where I discovered dining hall waffles and new depths of stress and caffeine and alcohol and more mature, cut bodies, and eating burgers at midnight and ramen noodles and boys with cute muscled thighs and brownies from the dessert station and chugging cheap beer. I gained the freshman 15 for 4 students all on my own because there was too much to worry about besides my weight, and my body escaped me. Meanwhile, I came out as gay, but not as fat, in 2011 and started learning how much gay culture favors the thin and the fit and the muscled. It's the first time I went to a gay club and saw people who were gay like me, which was at once liberating and suppressive. It was the first time I saw how important it was for gay people to look like some unattainable ideal. Look at all these thin people being thin together, was my most searing thought, and part of the reason why I never seriously tried dating after that night. Dating felt too much like putting myself on sale at a deli counter, to be picked alongside finer, shinier pieces of beef. I felt too much like a wedge of ham surrounded by beautiful cuts of prime rib. That summer, I decided to try to take control and join the gym across the street from our house. And if you're thinking, the gym was just across the street this whole time and you didn't go before then? Yes, that's exactly where it was. But any gym that was not directly beneath my body at any given moment might as well have been in another country. But motivated by the insecurity of my newfound gayness, I walked over to the gym one morning, paid the necessary $7 million membership fee, signed my name in blood, and committed myself to looking like Matthew McConaughey by the end of the summer. Of course, that dream lasted for about 45 minutes, which remains some of the worst minutes of my entire life, for about 1,000 reasons. I mean, going to the gym isn't a particularly pleasant experience to begin with, because all gyms are terrible, even the good ones. They smell like hot milk and old rags and garbage bags full of sweaty rubber. There's always a grown man in the corner grunting wildly at his own reflection, a teenager running dangerously fast on the treadmill so that you're scared to go anywhere near him, and an old woman who insists on making flirtatious eye contact with you during the entirety of your workout. And you know it's flirtatious, because she's constantly licking her lips. Plus, none of the machines come with instructions, so you may very well spend an entire hour pulling on what you think is part of a machine that trains your shoulders, but is actually just a piece of duct tape attached to a laundry machine that nobody told you not to touch. Gyms, generally speaking, are designed to humiliate and terrify you into emotional vulnerability so that gym employees can get you to buy things you don't actually want or need. Already emotionally distressed, I was an easy target for their hunt. Gym employees, like prowling lionesses, can detect weakness, and they smelled my fragility from miles away. They pounced the second I limped through the front door. "Welcome," a man with dazzling white teeth and a tight t-shirt shouted when I walked up to the front desk. "Would you like to start off your membership with a free personal training session? This is the Gym Predator's trademark maneuver." Determined as I was for McConaughey-like results in less than 10 weeks, and inclined as I am to accept any free thing that is offered to me, I accepted. "Wonderful," he said. "Let's set you up with a trainer." And he whistled over a man he introduced as Tim, who led me deep in the gym, far enough away so that I could no longer see the front doors or the light that poured in from outside. Tim, like most gym trainers, had too many muscles, which doesn't seem like it would be a problem in theory, but in the real world, it's like looking at a snake swallow a bag of onions. An approximate foot shorter than I was, Tim seemed to compensate for his height by adding 30 pounds of muscle for every inch he felt he lacked, which made him almost as wide as he was tall. Unprompted, he demonstrated the thickness of his chest by raising his fists in front of his face and struggling to make his forearms touch. This display was apparently meant to impress me, but all I could wonder was whether he could comfortably reach his own penis. I can only conclude, based on his abundance of unspent testosterone, that he could not. Wasting no further time on verbal introductions, Tim immediately launched into barking orders, which I was expected to wordlessly obey. Jumping jacks, push-ups, sit-ups, with no break in between, one after the other, all while Tim screamed what he believed to be encouragement in my face. "Push harder," he yelled through spittle. "We haven't even gotten started yet." And yet my muscles were already sending every distress signal they could muster to my brain, shaking wildly and burning hot. Sensing my waning energy, Tim continued bleeding. "Who's the hottest girl in your class?" he shouted. And my brain, at least the parts of it that weren't preoccupied with keeping the rest of my body from shutting down entirely, began to whir. In normal circumstances, I would have had the time and patience to address this question properly. Perhaps I would have mustered the energy to explain to Tim that sometimes boys like putting their penises inside other boys' penises. Perhaps I could have explained that I couldn't name the hottest girl in my class if you'd paid me $1,000, but I could rank the hottest 50 boys by 10 different criteria, including arms, abs, butts, calves, bulges, pecs, hair, jawlines, smiles, and thighs, the top of which in each category respectively I could have easily told him was Pat, Tom, Pat, Ryan, Stephen K., Stephen R., Jeremy, Kevin, Pat, and Bradley, Pat being the clear and obvious winner. In my distress, however, my brain could muster none of these activities.